My name is Jeff Trussell, and I'm the chair of the Department of Marine and Environmental Sciences, as well as the director of the Marine Science Center. And I, along with my colleagues from the College of Social Sciences and Humanities, the College of Architecture and Media Design, as well as the College of Engineering, have been working on shaping what we call the Urban Coastal Sustainability Initiative. And the really, in a nutshell, the fundamental goal of this initiative is to develop creative solutions for cleaner, smarter coastal communities. Cleaner, smarter, and safer coastal communities. We just came up with that tagline. And because human activities are so centered on coastlines around the globe, it's fundamentally important that we take interdisciplinary approaches to the sustainability of these ecosystems. These ecosystems are vitally important to our global economy, and they're becoming a flashpoint with respect to global security. As you, many of you may know, for example, our ports are a vital link for international cargo. Some of the neighborhood of $900 billion a year comes into our ports via cargo ships, and a lot of this cargo is unscanned. So it represents a major vulnerability with respect to our national security. And I'm sure that today's speaker will touch on some of these issues. But first, I'd like to introduce our director, Professor Steve Drechter. Steve is a provost and senior vice president for academic affairs at Northeastern University. Steve received his PhD at the University of California, Berkeley, and has been a pioneer in the field of electronic design automation. His distinguishing career includes election to the National Academy of Engineering, as well as being an avid diver and a fantastic photographer. Steve has championed the importance of interdisciplinary approaches to the fundamental problems facing our planet and our society, and as a result, he's been a big supporter of our Urban Coastal Sustainability Initiative. Please welcome Steve Drechter.
Thanks, Jeff. Now that you've given such a long introduction to me, I have to come up with even a longer introduction.
You can be brief, it's okay.
But thanks for inviting me to introduce the speaker, and let me also add my welcome to all of you. And Jeff is right, I do dive, so I appreciate the water that we're trying to make safe and sustainable. So I think many of you know that the university several years ago decided that its research was going to be focused on what we call use-inspired research, research that's really aimed at addressing very important societal problems. And two of those areas are sustainability and security. And the interesting thing about what I perceive this topic, this discussion going to be today, is actually a combination of those two. So it's not just the sustainability that's on the big, nice green sign, not red and black, but green, which is appropriate. But that it also talks about security as well, because ports clearly have both issues to deal with. And we live in a port city. We live in an urban coastal area. The number of urban coastal areas around the world are increasing, and the size of those are also increasing. So clearly very, very important problems. And today's speaker, Colonel Mark Mickleby, is a thought leader in this area. He's a decorated Marine, and he has served on numerous operational staff and command billets, and has participated in numerous combat operations as a Marine fighter pilot. He was telling me just a few minutes ago that the first time he was on an airplane was when he left his hometown in Minnesota and flew to the Naval Academy. So from there, he went to become a fighter pilot.
It's a crazy world, isn't it?
Pretty impressive. So from 2009 to 11, he served as Specialist Strategic Assistant to the Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, who tasked him and Captain Wayne Porter with creating a grand strategy for America based upon the concept of sustainability. But I think this is accurate. They decided we didn't, as a country, just need another strategy. What we needed was a narrative, a story that for the future that focused on the nation's values. So it took them 2 years, and they developed this narrative, and it was written up in a document called the National Strategic Narrative. I presume you'll talk a little bit about that today. So I'm really pleased to have you join us at Northeastern, and I ask you all to welcome Colonel Mark.
Thanks, sir. Appreciate it. Thank you. Hey, thanks for everyone coming out. And if I get loud and I yell, sorry, that's just what happens. So there we have it. And I'm also going to run around. I'm doing it more just to heckle the camera lady there because it'll be a pain in her rump. And I will go right on record right now. I'm doing it. Going to do my best to keep my potty mouth reined in. I'm really working. I got a 13-year-old, so I have to. But he's not here. So, but I will do my best. Okay, I promise.
I know.
See, I almost did it right there. So, but there we have. And we talk about grant strategy, sustainability, and all that kind of stuff. But I gotta say, right off the bat, I mean, and I'm glad we didn't use the E word. I'm gonna just kind of do a little sideshow here on this one. The E word being expert. All right, I'm not an expert. Don't want to be an expert. Can't claim to be an expert because we are going into the unknown. And so I try to shy away from experts. All you're going to hear is my opinion, my humble and widely ignored opinion, but it's mine. So hopefully I'd rather get into the questions and answers and hear what your thoughts are, because that's how I learn. And after all, it's all about me. So you know, it's about the learning, right? But wait until I'll just tee it up with kind of a framework of what the provost just said, kind of how we got to where we are. With what we did for Admiral Mullen. But right now what I'm focused on, because I'm now at New America Foundation as a senior fellow, is trying to figure out, okay, the so what. The National Strategic Narrative was an interesting piece of work, and I'll talk about that in a bit. But at the end of the day, you got to get on with the doing. All right? And so that's why I retired from the Marine Corps about 2 years ago for a bunch of different reasons. One of those reasons, though, I was absolutely freaking pissed off about the lack of capacity in Washington, D.C. to even do anything. And that's something we got to be concerned with as citizens, okay? So right now at New America Foundation, I'm working on the so what story of the narrative. I mean, okay, how are you actually going to go out and do it? Because right? At the end of the day, ideas are great, but you got to take ideas to action. Otherwise, what happens with those ideas, all right? And the stakes are pretty high. But there's a good news story to this. I'm mostly going to talk about opportunity, all right? Opportunity. And that's the nature of what this guy, Thomas Paine, he was kind of a hometown boy, I think, right, around here. 1776, wrote that little pamphlet called Common Sense, great title. And look at this quote. I mean, the cause of America is in a great measure the cause of all mankind. And well, in 1776, it was on the very first page of Common Sense, those words. Very first page. In 1776, he was talking about self-determination. You know, this is the basic right of an individual to be able to at least have a say in their future destiny, destiny of their children. All right? Now, right now, I challenge any of you to put your finger on the cause of America today. Because what is it? Because right now, as far as I can see, we're on a trend line of all we want to do is preserve the status quo. We just want to keep things the way they are. Well, guess what? That's not how the world operates. All right? The rest of the world wants to rise up too. And we're, quite frankly, getting in the freaking way. And I'll just make one case, one thing that I think is one of our biggest national embarrassments is the fact we didn't even talk about climate change in our last presidential election. Not one of our presidential candidates had the guts to talk about climate change. I almost swore there. That's horse hockey. Huh? That's embarrassment. That's not being a leader in the world. That's not taking a stand and saying, this is what we are for in America. We're not even addressing reality. We have got to get to that place to be a leader. And that is why we need to have a grand strategy. Grand strategy, we'll talk about a little definition of it, but that's the big enchilada. It's the big push for this country. That's what Admiral Mullen had me and Navy Captain Wayne Porter look at. Now, he didn't say sustainability. Right, I was happy as a little Marine down at Special Ops Command. I was doing leading strategy for Special Operations. And we were putting together a different type of way of doing stuff, taking systems view. We were really the guidance we got from Admiral Eric Olson, who was a Navy SEAL, 4-star commander of Special Operations Command at the time. His guidance to us as we were trying to figure out the very first strategy for Special Operations, his guidance was figure out how to get out in front of the sound of the guns. Well, let's just sink in for a minute. Figure out how to get out in front of the sound of the guns. In other words, figure out how do you push on the buttons in the security environment so we don't have to stink and fight. That is a pretty cool role for special operations. It's a pretty cool role for America to play, right? Because guess what? We cannot afford to continue the trend line. I've been a card-carrying member of the Marine Corps Club for a long time. And I'm telling you that passed since 9/11, we cannot sustain that pace as a nation, let alone just as a military. It's just costing us too much. Right? We've gotten into this position, we're so freaking focused on threat and risk that we're willing to sacrifice and expend our national prosperity in pursuit of security, security that's mostly defined on our 20th century past, not our 21st century reality. That is a design problem at scale. That is a huge design problem for a nation. Grand strategy is the thing that can get you around that. So when Admiral Mullen, he kind of saw what we were doing on a SOCOM, he had this squirrely little guy named Captain Wayne Porter contact me, and Wayne had a long time been a made man in the Mullen family, so he'd been on the staff for any number of years. Wayne called me up and said, hey, boss told me to find out who's doing this stuff down there. We struck up an instant friendship. This is about October 2008. All of a sudden in May 2009, you know, Wayne and I had been having this running conversation about grand strategy, what we should be doing, et cetera, et cetera. May 2009, all of a sudden, I get this phone call from Wayne, and he's all out of breath. He's like, hey, can you help me with something? I was like, sure. You know, I'm down in Tampa, Florida, at MacDill Air Force Base, the Special Ops Command. He's up in the Pentagon, and he said, we got to write a grand strategy for the nation. Can you help me out? I was like, sure. Literally, we'll say, well, how hard can it be? Come on, we'll just knock it out, and then we'll be done. We can go back to our lives and, you know, keep doing other stuff. So we figured about maybe 2 months, maybe 4 months. We bamboozled orders for me. I left. I got up to the Pentagon in July of 2009. And Admiral Mullen kind of sat us down and said, okay, just go off in the corner and figure out a grand strategy. Let me see what that would look like. All right? And I'm sure he had no idea what we were going to come up with, which was also pretty cool that the senior ranking military officer just kind of said, just go figure it out. Let me see what that would look like. I should say this to take this time. If you ever wonder, and that was my first time in the Pentagon, my only time ever in D.C., my only exposure to ever somebody in that kind of role, that kind of position, the Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff. But I'll tell you this much. If you ever wonder who the grand poobahs that sit up there in D.C., you know, I can just tell you from my experience being around Admiral Mullen, first of all, infinitely patient guy, trust me. You know, it was 2 years, and we gave him a lot of horse shit to deal with. But infinitely patient guy, infinitely intellectually curious type of guy, but also one of the most decent men I've ever met in my life. So if you're ever wondering what their calculus is, the guy just oozed integrity. He got up every morning to do the right thing, literally, every morning. And he put up with a lot of stuff in D.C., if you can imagine, but every day committed to doing the right thing. So I just needed to do that advertisement. I'm infinitely grateful to him for allowing me to have this opportunity to focus on this kind of a problem. So when Wayne and I, after we left Admiral Mullen, we got in our little office and he sat us down and we said, okay, how the hell are we going to do this? Well, how do you do grand strategy? Now, if you're looking at a schoolhouse, you know, if you go to the war college, they tell you ends, ways, means. You know, it's ends, ways, means. You know, it's what everybody says. You read anybody that's a pundit on strategy, it's ends, ways, means. Well, I'm here to tell you that maybe that worked in the Cold War when the world was a little bit more linear, right, a little less complex. Doesn't work in the reality we face right now. It's linear. It's deterministic. It's like you can push on any number of variables and get a deterministic end. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. We don't see that type of framework operating in our world, yet we keep pushing it. And so Wayne and I said, we are not going to do that. We are not going to contribute to the freaking legions of strategies that come out of Washington, D.C. I mean, we've got strategies a go-go. You know, we got a national security strategy. We got a national defense strategy. We got a national military strategy. We got a national health security strategy. We got national bike safety strategies. We've got strategies, and I guarantee you, some people, I asked a question last night, anybody read the national security strategy? Some people raise their hands. And I said, what did it say? And they're like, I don't know, but I read it, right? I've read it, it was my business to read it, and I could never figure out what the hell we're supposed to do with it, because they know none of those strategies make any prioritization decisions. They don't even make any decisions. They talk about the world we wish it could be, and mostly that wish is how the world used to be, you know? That's not strategy. That's not dealing with our reality. And so Wayne and I said, we are not going to contribute to that. So what we decided we needed to do was to write a story. A story that, with a little intellectual emotional honesty, would look at where we currently are today. And more importantly, what could we be in the future? What could we do in the future? What does the world need for us to do in the future? Because the cause of America is in a great measure the cause of all mankind. And we're at that point in the world where the stakes are that high. And I truly believe, and I agree with Tom Friedman, that the world does need an America, but it needs an America that is at its best, one that's willing to lead. And that's what Wayne and I wanted to talk to. We wrote a narrative, and we didn't write a narrative, a story, for Washington, D.C., because quite frankly, who gives a shit what they think in Washington, D.C. right now? The game is a game. What we wrote it for were citizens of the United States. For me, the calculus was Mom and Dad Mickleby and YZ of Minnesota. you know, lower middle class, fiscally conservative, socially moderate, just Americans that are just plugging away. And if we talk to them in a different type of way, they would engage them as citizens and not placate them as if they're merely residents. That, hey, you pay your taxes and you can continue to live here, but don't worry about keeping your yard up, you know? That's not us. That's not America. Americans, we need citizens to be engaged. All right? So we wrote this narrative. And, oh, by the way, we wrote it. I got there in July of 09. We wrote it by August of 09. It took us a month. They just locked ourselves down to think through some of the stuff we'll talk about. The weirdness of Washington, D.C. is we weren't allowed to release it till April of 2011. Because, you know, cut to the chase, but the bottom line, we're saying, hey, sustainability needs to become our national strategic imperative for the 21st century. Period. And it was, are you shitting me? You're a Marine and a sailor working for the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and that's what you came up with? You know? You're going to scare the children, you know? So it took a long time to get it out the door, right? So go figure. And there's a lot of good reasons for it, too, that we can talk about later if you want, but I don't want to get too sidetracked. If you can tell, I'm a little bit ADD, so we're going to end up going, like, doing Ring Around the Rosie around the world a couple times, so sorry. All right? So national strategic narrative. So bottom line, what we looked at is what, you know, the Soviet Union went away in 1989, you know, when the wall came down, formally went away in 1991. You know, and here we're sitting in the year is 2009. In that time, basically the 20 years, what the hell did we do? What have we done? We're just kind of like marking time, and we even had nuts saying, yeah, that's the end of history. Holy cow, I hope not. I mean, what's the point, right? End of history? I don't think so. All right? We have never really restocked where we needed to be. We never recalibrated our country to where it needed to be and where we needed to go and what the needs of the world were and our role in that. And so that's what Wayne and I said, what would be the replacement of containment? Now, when George Kennan cranked out that idea with a long telegram in 1946, you know, he's down in the basement of U.S. Embassy in Moscow, and he gacks out the long telegram, sends that off, goes in to become the Foreign Affairs article in 1946, Sources of Soviet Conduct, the X article, where he lays out that argument of containment, that if we can just keep them from expanding out, and we turn this thing into a contest of political and economic systems, holy cow, the Soviet Union is going to collapse of its own internal contradictions. And guess what? It worked. Mm-hmm. It worked. By the way, George Kennan said containment was over in about 1957-58 when Red China diverged away from the Soviet Union. He said, all right, it's collapsed. Let's go on with the next thing. Late 1950s, he was saying that. Nobody listened to him, so we just kind of waited till it, like, formally, you know, folded up their flag and changed their, went to the tricolors again, you know. But technically, he said, the guy that came up with it said, that strategy's over, we got to go into the next thing. And oh, by the way, the thing that he was looking at is our development as a nation, our physical development, built environment, environmental stature, condition, our waterways, our soils. That's where he was seeing the next thing is. So I can't claim that these are all new ideas. He was seeing it all the way back in the 50s. Interesting. But what we ended up saying was, okay, if containment was the grand strategy of the United States that we operated off of, pretty cool stuff, but it was a control strategy. It was a strategy that leveraged force and power. In order to contain the Soviet Union, we had to leverage force and power. It was a way you could, in a way, you could treat the world as if it was a closed system. As if you could push on given variables to a deterministic end. And mostly that was because of the nature of information. You know, the state, believed, whether you liked it or not, the state owned the control of information. Now, so it was kind of artificially a closed system. Now, information age, the world truly operates truly as an open system. And when you start talking about open systems, you have to start talking in ecological terms, in evolutionary terms. So it's no longer an issue of force, power, and control. It's an issue of how do you evolve in a global ecology, in an openness system, and what Wayne and I started calling a strategic ecology. Because you have to think, your calculus turns completely 180 out. Now, if you try to take that containment mindset of control and apply it to an open systems framework, guess what happens? Second law of thermodynamics takes off, and you get pretty freaking confused. All right? Because things start pinging around, I can't keep up with it, holy shit, what am I going to do? So what do? We keep running around. And guess what? Guys like me end up going and headbutting people all over the world because that's the only thing we can figure out what to do. That's not the face of America. I mean, after all, we're not the land of threat and risk. We're the land of opportunity. So why do we treat everything as if it's a threat and a risk? Right? So what would it be if it's not containment? What is this open systems thing? Right? If it's not control, what is it? And again, I just want to re-stress this thing. We are trying to apply control dynamics to something you can't control. Anybody know Epictetus, Stoic philosopher? Oh, read his stuff. It's pretty cool stuff. A little book called The Enchiridion. And I can just sum up Stoic philosophy real quick. It's like, if you try to control the uncontrollable, you're going to be a miserable son of a bitch. Well, there we are, right? Here we are. That's what trying to put control structures onto an open system. All right? So what would it be? If it's not containment anymore, how do we deal with an open system? Well, that's, again, you have to start thinking in evolutionary terms, ecological terms. We started looking at Darwinian theory. Now, everyone says Darwin's thing was survival of the fittest. Yeah, I maybe kind of mentioned that stuff, but his real point was about the spring bed. If you read Darwin's stuff, he talks about a spring bed, a little river bed, and there's a little biosphere. And every little player inside that biosphere has got a role to play, whether you're an insect, whether you're plant life, whatever. You know, everybody's got a role to play. We got to start thinking about what is our role in the world. How do we be the best competitor in the world? All right? And an interesting word, competitor. It's not the original concept of competitor. Competition is not win lose. Believe it or not, the etymological the original concept around competitor comes from Latin competare. Competare means to strive together. Go figure. I think I mentioned this last night. Competition isn't about starting pistol go, trip the guy next to you, kick him in the head, and run across the finish line. It's the initial concept is the win-win framework. So instead of talking about threat and risk and always focused on conflicting interests in the geopolitical realm, why aren't we focused on converging interests as our default setting? It puts places like China in a new light, even Iran in a new light. Right? It's not about conflict. It's about converging interests. That's the only way we're going to make it as a human race. And you're talking to a freaking Marine. If I can say it, you can say it too. All right? And so if you're going to move from containment to this open system thing, Wayne and I kept coming back, what is the big strategic concept? And we kept coming back to the word, the S word, sustainability. Now, when we said sustainability needs to be our national strategic imperative for the 21st century, we had no idea it was such a bad word. I had never heard about Agenda 21, but I guess it's a big deal. Anyway, Agenda 21, apparently there's a UN global conspiracy to take over the world, you know, sustainability. Come on, get over it, right? But that's what it was. And that's what we said, sustainability, and here is why. The enduring national interests of America. Now, if you go to the War College, you're going to tell you you've got vital interests, you have important interests, you have less than important interests. And they have these herringbones, and people sit there and scratch their chin and think about all these different interests. Well, bullshit. Why do we make it so hard? All right? Then we read John Maeda's book, Laws of Simplicity. Pretty smart guy. I think he's from MIT. Sorry, it's right up the road. But, you know, they get a lot of money. So, but anyways, it was a pretty cool book, Laws of Simplicity. You know, keep it freaking simple, you know? And that also goes back to, you know, complexity theory, Murray Gell-Mann. Anybody read his stuff? He's at the Santa Fe Institute, right? Got to pursue ideal complexity. The minimum length message to convey the essence of the system. What's the essence of our system? The essence of our system as a nation is we need to be able to pursue our enduring interests of prosperity and security for the long haul. Enduring national interests of prosperity and security. You can't have prosperity without security. You can't have security without prosperity. And oh, by the way, because we're America, we've got a certain value system that Wayne and I defined as articulated in the preamble of our Constitution. You know, we can go over that one a little bit, but that pretty much informs our national values as we saw it. Now, that can be a sticky thing around values, so we just wanted to pin it to what our nation's been built on, the preamble of the Constitution. That's our system of interest. Prosperity, security, informed and empowered, and constrained by our values. Okay? And like I said before, right now, because we've lost sight of that inner relationship between prosperity and security, right now, we are in pursuit of security. This illusory condition of security is defined by our 20th century past, and we're spending our prosperity to get there. It's a losing proposition. So sustainability is interesting as an ecological concept, as a grand strategic concept, because the definition of sustainability is an organism's ability to remain diverse and productive over time. Diversity, depth, redundancy, resilience. Now, Steve and I were talking a lot about this yesterday, right? I think it's cool you guys want to stand up a resilience and security thing. I think that's the right thing to do, right? Because resilience in marine parlance is your ability to take a gut punch and come back swinging. Right now, we're brittle as hell. Right? We get a little boo-boo, and God dang, we go nuts. Right? Well, guess what? You're going to get hit again. We're all going to get hit again. Boston had an unfortunate incident, but it's not always going to be around some nutbags blowing off bombs. It's also going to be hurricanes. It's also going to be about fisheries collapsing, which we already saw in the late 70s right here in the cod industry. That's coming around the corner if we don't freaking do something about it quick. We need to start building some depth into the system. That's security 21st century style. It's not from our shores outward and keeping all the bad people away. And trust me, there's bad people out there. We're seeing that unfold in Nairobi right now. But that's why God made Marines, and they made sailors so they can sailors can take Marines to get to the fight. And Army and Air Force supports Marines when they're actually doing the real work. Right? So Marines go, and we headbutt people into submission. There's plenty of work for that, and that's why we got a Marine Corps. Right? And everybody else to support. But that cannot define our approach to the world. Security 21st century style has everything to do with our functioning systems, food, water, energy, built environment, transportation, education, manufacturing, doing it in a way that makes logical sense, that that meets our needs as human beings, but also fits within the planetary boundaries. That's security 21st century style. And oh, by the way, that also maps to the second part of that definition and why it maps to our enduring interest, that's definition of sustainability, is that an organism needs to be productive over time. And we've got to come to grips where we live in a resource-constrained environment. But yet, only way we measure our productivity in the form of growth is around quantitative measures. How much GDP do we have? You know, what's the quarterly profit margin? Well, I'm a good old-fashioned capitalist. I want to make some quant too, but I also know I want to give my child and my grandchildren a world worth living in. Because there's this little line at the end of the preamble of the Constitution, and it says, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union," the last one is, "to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity." It's our mandate as citizens to think in those terms about our posterity. And if we're going to be productive, we need to talk about growth, but we have to talk about qualitative growth. Because I'm here to tell you, if one-third of our nation is clinically obese, two-thirds are overweight, right? We spend $200 billion on type 2 diabetes alone in this country every year, which is a largely preventable disease. One in four emergency visits deals with asthma, usually for kids because of the freaking air that they're breathing. And we're spending money on it. We're not even doing anything about it. Right? It's crazy. It's nuts. That's not a measure of happiness. That's not a measure of growth. I mean, again, we can learn something from a little country called Bhutan with gross national happiness. Because I'm telling you, we are not happy. Matter of fact, if you look at our politics, we don't have politics, we have ideologies now. All right? And that's just a manifestation of our fear, our dissatisfaction, and it's about time the citizens rise up and start doing something about it instead of whining about it. All right? Sorry, had to get that off my chest. So we come up with this idea. Sustainability is a national strategic pair. We write a national strategic narrative. It gets out there with some fanfare in April 2011, and everyone's going, great. Well, what about, so what? Well, that's what I'm doing now at the New America Foundation. Because here's the so what. Not only does sustainability map to our national strategic, enduring national interests of prosperity and security, it also maps to a quintessentially unique American way of doing grand strategy. Now, here's the tagline on the board. When America does grand strategy well, we stand on our economy, we allow our economy to do a heavy lifting, we align our governing institutions and our foreign policy to take on the great global challenge of our age. Great global challenge of our age. Right? We did it in World War II. We were the arsenal of democracy. Right? We fundamentally rewickered our economy so we can arm and equip our allies, fight a global war, two fronts, against global fascism. And oh, by the way, in the midst of doing that, we're looking over the horizon, we're saying, holy cow, Soviet Union's coming up, Corn Kennan comes up with his concept. We continue this pattern of grand strategy going into the Cold War. Containment is the informing logic, it's the strategic concept. We also do the strategic construct. We do the National Security Act in 1947 that builds the institutions that carry out the Cold War, and we rewicker our economy to that end, focused on manufacturing, housing, and agriculture to get our economy going, sustain ourselves through that long haul, that twilight struggle against the communists. Right? Communism being that great global challenge that we saw. And it worked. But what's our challenge today? I'm here to tell you, it's global unsustainability. As a human species, we're consuming 1.5 planets worth of stuff just to sustain ourselves. Now, I'm a nose-picking Marine. That math doesn't work. Now, everyone's trying to go to the U.S. model. Well, guess what? If everyone consumed like America did, it'd be 4.5 planets worth of resources. 4.5 planets worth of resources. I don't know where we're going to get that stuff. And there's not enough on the moon. All right? There's not enough asteroids out there to go farm or mine. It's about our behavior. It's a choice. We have the capacity to do this. And so what we're doing at New America Foundation, this is just a framework. Trust me, I'm going to get this big-ass slide off here quick. But there is a grand strategic framework that we can do, we can go at. If we could just at least talk with, again, intellectual, emotional honesty about what our present challenge is. It's global unsustainability. And it's not just that we're going to 9 billion people. That's what the economic inclusion. We have to find a way to lift all boats. We have to take a humanist approach to the world. Sustainability needs to be humanist. Stop talking about it as if it's a green movement. It's a human movement. It's a world movement. If it's just green, then it puts it into that either or. You can easily stick it off to the side. Sustainability has got to be organizing logic for society. Economic inclusion. We've got 9 billion people coming in, but here's the real number because it goes right into ecosystem depletion. 9 billion is a scary number? Yeah, I guess so. The real scary number is that 3 billion people need to be folded into the global middle class. And when they arrive there, I'm talking about China, India, Brazil, Russia, across the world, and we don't have the right as Americans to say, slow down, right? We've got to help them figure it out. But where that 3 billion people in the middle class, when they arrive, their resource consumption goes up 300%. That's a scary number, all right? That's a scary number. And right now we're in a contained depression. This thing about monetary, you know, quantitative easing, fiscal and monetary policy, you know, all we're going to have to do is just wait a little bit longer. We're just going to keep interest rates down, and then holy cow, then we're going to get to go back to the 1980s. Bullshit. We're fundamentally at a historic deleveraging point, the same level of deleveraging as what was required post-1929. We're in that. This is a fundamental reframe of a global economy that we're facing right now, period. And at the end of the day, we've got a huge resilience deficit across all our global systems. Now, I was talking about natural systems, but man-made systems. That's why when something like a tsunami hits in a little place called Fukushima, you know, they had the nuclear disaster and stuff. Well, guess what? Look at how tightly wound our systems are. Because there's a little factory just north of Fukushima that got shut down, and it made a $3 gasket for cars. $3 gasket. Well, guess what? A month later, when the supply chain ran out, the four major automakers in the United States production went way down. And you can't show causation, but there's a strong correlation. That's the same time that our national unemployment rate went from 8.9% to 9.1% for a $3 gasket based on a natural disaster. Interesting. What kind of resilience? Now, we may be hyper-efficient, but that doesn't mean we're effective. We've got to get resilience in our global systems because we're going to have more shocks coming our way. I'm not going to get into the U.S. foreign policy and governance stuff because I don't want to fall asleep in front of you, but it's important, all right? But let's talk about it. But the bottom line is what's going to make this thing drive. Remember, when America does grand strategy, well, we stand on our economy. We have got to get our economy, mostly because of that contained depression thing, get it moving. Now, Ben Bernanke is right about one thing. If we really want to get our economy going, we've got to find big, huge pools of demand so that we can liberate this $5 trillion of corporate cash and throw it towards that demand, right? Well, it's not the demand of the past, right? This is the cool thing about sustainability. Sustainability informs this economic engine. It's just not a fluff piece. Because look, the market forces at play are around housing, specifically walkable communities, regenerative agriculture, and resource productivity, fundamentally reducing our resource intensity per unit of GDP. Just some quick numbers. Walkable communities, smart growth. 56% of Americans, this is according to the National Association of Realtors, 56% of Americans don't like where they live. Specifically, 56% of Americans seek the attributes of smart growth. Now, why is that? It's because we're sitting on a truly historic demographic shift in our own country, and we're asleep at the frickin' switch. Right now, baby boomers are downsizing. You know, I'm a baby boomer. I want to downsize, damn it. You know, I just got to get my kid out of the college, hopefully. Maybe they'll come here. But for half of that 56% are mostly made up of baby boomers. They're downsizing. They don't want to be stuck in the suburbs anymore. You know, their keys are getting taken away from them. They don't want to be sitting there eating applesauce the rest of their life. They want to be engaged. They want to be in a community. They want to have a place where they have access to services, right? And be engaged in a freaking community. Huge. But the other half of that are you guys, the millennials. Are you guys millennials? Whatever the hell you are, you're in it, all right?
Some of us are.
Yeah. They don't want to go out in the suburbs and live in a gated community either because they saw what happened to mom, dad, and grandma and grandpa. And plus, I mean, for me, as I always say, I grew up watching Brady Bunch, so it made sense to live in the suburbs of Minneapolis, you know? I mean, what the hell? You know, we even had a station wagon with a panel thing on there, you know? I mean, what the hell? It was good. But kids today are watching, I guess you're watching, what, Friends or something? Whatever, the hip happening lifestyle? You know? So you've got a built environment that actually maps your social environment, and that's where millennials are now coming in to their first housing purchase. They're starting their families. That's 56%, yet only 2% of new housing startups will map to that demand. What a wasted opportunity. Now, again, nose picking marine, 56% demand, 2% supply. Where should I go? Where should I invest? It sure as hell in suburban sprawl, all right? But a lot of other reasons for public health, et cetera, we can talk about later. Huge opportunity. And just to give you some numbers around that one, the returning GIs, a 10 million man juggernaut that we sent overseas to fight World War II and they came back, not only the GI Bill, but that influx, demographic influx back in the United States fueled our economy in the form of suburban sprawl up to the late 70s, early 80s. And this demand signal is three times greater than that. Three times. Huge economic opportunity to fuel this economy and get at the systems that are killing us today, mostly producing climate change, eroding our soil, our public health. Built environment is a way around that. Highly recommend you look up the research of Dr. Dick Jackson from UCLA. The numbers are very compelling from a public health standpoint. Second one, regenerative agriculture. You know, is it just organic farming? Well, not anymore. It's a way we've got to be able to feed the world. According to the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, by 2050, we have to increase our global food production by 60% in order to accommodate demographic shifts. And 100% of that has to be regenerative because we've already exceeded planetary boundaries in terms of growing food and water. You know, water is another great security thing if you want to dive into that. But regenerative agriculture could be the solution because that 60% increase, that's just a market share waiting for us to dive into that market, right? And oh, by the way, this is a little bit Machiavellian. We can do it when we can make a shift to regenerative agriculture when it makes the most economic sense because food prices are at an all-time high. Yeah, kind of scary, I know. But yet, here we go. We crank out. Last year, we put 40% of our grain harvest into our gas tanks to keep freaking gas prices down. Are you shitting me? Now, that's a hard little thing for me to explain as a Marine overseas to go, well, yeah, I know your food prices are high, you're having a tough time feeding your family, but holy shit, Americans need to get to Disneyland in the summertime, you know, come on. You've got to understand where we're coming from on this one. Well, they don't understand. Right? And here's the other interesting thing, just from an economic standpoint. Rodale Institute just got done doing, a study, a 30-year farm trial study, per acre, equivalent comparison between, we'll call it industrial ag, our current ag model, versus regenerative agriculture. Per acre, just to cut to the chase, per acre, regenerative agriculture is three times more profitable because now we're including the full value chain of what it takes to get food to the table. Specifically, the 10 to 14 calories of petroleum energy that it takes to get one calorie of food into your belly using our current standard model. It doesn't work. And, oh, by the way, in times of drought, in equivalent yields, by the way, but most importantly, in times of drought, climate change kind of comes to mind, actually 30% greater yields with regenerative agriculture because of deeper root systems. It takes less water, 40% less energy, 45% less carbon emission. And it creates a carbon sink to deal with this pesky little thing known as climate change, seeing as that we just went over 400 parts per million last May in our atmosphere, parts per million CO2. The last thing, so makes all the economic sense in the world, there's a global market for it. And it's time to make that shift. And if anybody's questioning whether we can do it or not, you know, I get that all the time. Well, it'll never happen. Can't possibly do it. Bullshit. In 1972, Secretary of Agriculture Earl Butz, working for Richard Nixon, made the decision we're going to plant fence row to fence row. Overt policy. We're going to use technology. We can increase yields. It's going to be great. We're going to feed the world and the communists are going to collapse just because we're going to be the breadbasket of the world. Well, guess what? It worked. Well, 40 years later, that system, that wheels are falling off the cart. And if you're not worried about this from a national security perspective, you better be. Because it scares the hell out of me, not only as a Minnesota boy, but as a Marine looking at national security stuff, that 50% of Iowa's topsoil is gone. But according to Michigan State University, the place where we grow our food, the breadbasket of America, there's places where 75% of that topsoil is gone. And near and dear to our hearts right here, the cod industry, if we don't take notice of what Mother Nature does when we start mucking around with with natural systems, if anybody knows systems theory, you know, peak, 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 and then big collapse, take a look at the cod industry. Peak yields right up till about late 70s. and then all of a sudden it collapsed down to 1% of the population pre-collapse. We're playing with fire here. And oh, by the way, that system, that cod system, we're only back up to 30% of the pre-collapse population level. And that's with very aggressive policies to bring it back. Okay? We're doing that with our dirt. We're doing that with our dirt. Got to be careful. If you don't want to go the path of the Romans and the Sumerians, we better pay attention to our freaking dirt. All right? That's why it's important. And productivity revolution, we've fundamentally got to reduce our resource intensity per unit of GDP. And by the way, we have the technologies to do it. I'm talking about 3D printing, stereolithography, you know, all the advanced manufacturing techniques, advanced materials, also regenerative or renewable energy. All right? What are we freaking waiting for? You know, this bullshit about energy independence. There is no independence, first of all, in the world. And second of all, you know, if they say, we got enough hydrocarbons in the United States, we can fuel our economy for 50 to 100 years, and we can be a net exporter. Well, goody gumdrops, you know? So, I mean, it's like, you know, Wayne Porter, the guy I worked with for Evermore, he says, it's like we're in a race for the last pack of cigarettes. I mean, we just got to get it, you know? We're not even questioning whether it's what it's going to do to us once we start knocking those heaters down. Well, it's the same thing. How stupid is that? And still, within the lifetime of my kid, what do we do when we run out then? Assuming there is no climate change problems, what do we do when we run out? We better get off our ass and figure it out, because you don't turn on a dime and all of a sudden, okay, well, now let's have new energy. You know, we're feeling that right now. Now's the time to figure out. So I highly recommend you look at the stuff that Lester Brown has written at Earth Policy Institute, as well as Amory Lovins at the Rocky Mountain Institute, because they have a pragmatic, doable transition plan that we could start implementing today. Today. Specifically, Amory Lovins' book, Reinventing Fire. It's powerful stuff. Bottom line, what does this mean to Main Street USA? Grant strategy is great. I mean, I really feel real good talking about big numbers. What does it mean to America? Well, this is the cool thing, that this economic driving, these economic sectors that are informed by the concept of sustainability go right down to Main Street USA and can have impact right now in our main economy. Right now, our economy, walk with me, is focused right down here. Now, this chart is for every dollar, and I hate charts, I'm sorry, but I had to put it up there. For every buck you put into a whatever given economic sector, you have, this is how much money you get out of it. So right now, our economy is pretty much pointed at retail, trade, to finance, services. That's pretty much where our economy points at. Globalization, the world is flat, all that stuff. For every buck you put in, you're only getting 55 cents to 63 cents of ancillary economic activity out of it. That's crap. No wonder we're getting our asses handed to us in a global fashion in the economy. If we focus on those big bins of demand, guess where we point our economy? At the toppest, or the toppest, I speak English, at the top level economic driving sectors we have available to us. We're talking about manufacturing. Every buck you put in, you get a buck 35. Agriculture, believe it or not, for every buck you put in, you get a buck 20. Construction, 97 cents. Transportation, 95 cents. That's why when you get good design, and I don't care if you're in Portland, Oregon, or Salt Lake City, Utah, it has nothing to do with politics, it has everything to do with economics. That's why when Portland put out a $100 million investment in a light rail system, they generated $3 billion of economic activity. That's what we're talking about. It's all freaking sustainable. And just so you know, again, so politics, Salt Lake City used the same design framework in their Envision Utah, something that John Huntsman started. Has not, you know, and they predominantly voted McCain-Palin back when these numbers were run. Right? It has nothing to do with politics. It has everything. What kind of community do you want to have? What kind of economic development do you want to have? Do you want to go for the long haul so your kids and your grandkids have a good place to live? That's what grand strategy is about. And so, like I said, grand strategy at the end of the day, you actually have to get on with the doing. Well, this is how we're doing it. This is our design. Man, you can't even see that, can you? All right, I'll talk about it. All right? This is our framework for implementation. Strategy is one thing. Doing is another. You have to have an implementation framework. So we're doing a top-down, bottom-up push. And we're starting with the economic stuff first, not the foreign policy stuff and everything else. Because the bottom line logic is we've got to fix our in-house stuff first. We've got to build our own strengths so that in the foreign policy context we can have credibility influence abroad. This whole framework is designed around walking the talk. All right? Now, being a Scandinavian, Norwegian type of guy, I love to quote Beowulf, so I knew I did it last night, so if you heard this one before, suck it up. All right? But there's this great quote in Beowulf, you know? They're Danish Vikings, but okay. Still Vikings. But it's, behavior that's admired is the path to power among people everywhere. Behavior that's admired. We've got to get to admirable behavior, and you have to get on with the doing, and this is a way to do it. So we're doing a top-down push first, hitting private sector, corporate America, because Washington, D.C. is broken. So we're in partnership with the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, PricewaterhouseCoopers, McKinsey, Shell Oil, a lot of different folks in the bin, to frame out, take this economic thesis, this theory of change, at the macro level and take it to a 2.0 level. In the process of doing that, creating the political safe zone for those politicians that are on both sides of the aisle right now, they're there. They just don't have the political top cover. Private sector can provide that to put them into the space where we can start catalyzing change. In things like an ag bill, since we don't have that, a farm bill, transportation bill, an energy policy that makes sense, that gets us to a place and not just bides time. Right? This is where we got to go. Private sector's got to be the change agent because it's not going to happen in the public sector at the national level. Right? However, comma, we've got a bottom up. So top down, bottom up. Bottom up, we're hitting at the very local, regional level. And looking at Michael Porter from Harvard. Sorry, another guy right down the road, but I can't help. You know, I don't mind either. You know? But he came up, you know, his concept around regional clusters. Now, he primarily focused on industrial commons, the industrial sector. What we're taking is a concept called full-spectrum sustainability as the organizing logic for local, regional economies. And we're doing pilot projects, three specific right up front. I'll talk about in a second. But to take this concept of full-spectrum sustainability, of converging sectors of food, water, energy, built environment, manufacturing, education, build a competitive, innovative workforce for a 21st century reality, and make it real. Because at that level, the change agents are going to be mayors. Mayors are pretty powerful little tools, okay? Because they actually have to produce. They cannot survive in a political environment that's wedded to only ideologies, calcified ideologies that only produce divisive ultimatums. They actually have to be productive. And the two things that they need to do is provide economic opportunity to draw industry into where they are, and they also have to create a competitive, innovative, trained, educated workforce that those industries can use. And that's what we're doing at a regional level. And just to let you know, the three primary ones right now, Upper Midwest, Lake Erie Crescent, and the Southeast. But there's more bubbling up, okay? So actually doing these things. And which brings me to the third component is innovation financing. Without tapping capital, there's doesn't happen. So we're figuring out the new financial frameworks to make this stuff happen. So we've already been in the White House talking to them. Tomorrow I fly to D.C. and we're bringing in these projects from across the country to Washington and start figuring out the financial engineering. How do you create new capital stacks? So we're putting these things together as investable things and shoving capital their way. All sorts of different instruments. I can get into the gory details on that. I don't want to, but I can. Right? And the most, here's a kind of a cool thing. Post New Year, sometime maybe January, February, date hasn't been set yet, New York Stock Exchange is hosting us around this idea. Because they recognize, this is the cool part, this is a global opportunity. If we figure out in the United States, guess what? We talked about our strength at home becomes our credibility and influence abroad. Where we do smart growth at home, it can become our smart power abroad. They see the global opportunity in China, in India, in Brazil, that this design framework and the financial engineering that makes it real can really set us on a different course. Not only to make money, but again, that humanist approach to better the human condition. If you think that it's airy-fairy, tough. All right? Because this full-spectrum sustainability thing is the way that we're going to get public, private, sector, and academic institutions all the resources available to converge in a space that matters. Particularly the academic community, guess what? The ivory tower no longer applies. The laboratory that you work in is now the community that you live in. Otherwise, you're just spinning your wheels. Right? Applied research has something different, or has a new application now. And most importantly, it gives the opportunity for citizens to engage again as citizens. And not just be a resident that pays rent in the form of taxes, because Rousseau already warns us about this stuff in The Social Contract when he says, as soon as a citizen prefers to serve the state with his purse rather than his person, that society's already lost. And guess where we are right now? Now we're not even willing to pay freaking taxes. Right? We got to start putting some sweat equity in the game and blood equity in the game. And I'm here to tell you, it's going to take citizens' engagement. in this type of space if we're going to turn the ship. And oh, by the way, I'm not the first one to think of that one either. Everyone remember, well, you know, General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower. In 1961, he had a farewell address. He still warned about the military-industrial complex. Anybody remember that? Ever heard of that? Well, it's alive and well, if you're worried about it. But he's also, beyond his warning about that military-industrial complex, he also provided a solution. In that speech, he said, "Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can ensure the proper meshing of our instruments of defense with our peaceful intentions of the peaceable in a nation." I paraphrase. But that's what he said. Right? We've got to, today we are neither alert nor are we knowledgeable as citizens. We have got to get to that place. We have to refine the power of being a citizen and engage in here. And through this economic opportunity model, I believe we can. And just to give you a sense of where we're doing this thing, I don't want to hang, well, we're doing the upper Midwest, just to give you a sense that this is actually happening. University, partnering in the upper Midwest with University of Minnesota, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, Regional Council of Mayors, a bunch of private sector folks. But we kicked this thing off. The University of Minnesota hosted it on the 7th of February of this year. And we are now in, putting in the proposals to get planning grants, but that we're also developing the projects that are going to be presented tomorrow in front of those with the money, the capital, to start creating those investment engines around this concept of full spectrum sustainability, both in Wisconsin and in Minnesota. It's happening. We're doing it. Same in the Lake Erie Crescent Cluster in partnership with Michigan State University, Case Western, Oberlin, as well as University of Toledo, just from the academic institutions. We also have a bunch of private sector and public sector folks involved in this, to include the city of Detroit, because I guess they're probably looking for options at this point, right? The idea is that we're creating ecosystems of opportunities, because the problem with Detroit wasn't just Detroit. That's why they failed in trying to fix it. They tried to fix it within the confines of Detroit. They didn't recognize they're part of a greater ecology, an economic ecology. And that's what we're trying to create, these economic zones of opportunity. And guess what? Michigan State is going to be leading, but they're going to be presenting a plan on how to help fix Detroit on Thursday in D.C. And we're going to see if we can get some capital flowing in their direction as well. Maybe starting small, but we have plenty of room to grow. And then there's another one in our southeast. I'm not going to get around that, but in partnership with Georgia Tech, University of South Carolina, College of Charleston, as well as the cities of Charleston, Columbia, Atlanta, and Savannah. Cool thing about this thing is that they have two federal ports in Charleston and Savannah. This is where it becomes global real quick. If we just think in these connected systems terms, we're putting federal dollars in to improve those two ports. Meanwhile, the Panama Canal is being improved. And guess what? That's a great valve for Asia to send us all their goods, but meanwhile, the ships that come in full, they end up leaving empty. The only thing they leave, they've got a bunch of chicken and chopsticks, literally. You know, believe it or not, lumber in Georgia has turned into chopsticks for China, as well as chickens. Go. That's not a freaking industry. That's a clown show. Right? Start developing industries around advanced manufacturing. Now we're developing products that a global economy can use, and it's within the confines, the planetary boundaries that we face. So just a timeline, just to make this real. We're looking to have impact by 2020. Yes, it's geared around the presidential election cycle. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean we have it solved? No, but we're in a place now where we have this National Prosperity and Security Act, the guts of it framed out, because we're going to go through the economics of it. We're partnering with the National Defense University to figure out the foreign policy framework that we need that makes the guts for a National Prosperity and Security Act that fundamentally gets into the authority structures of the U.S. Code, same way the National Security Act in 1947 did, but to reframe our approach so we can deal with the world as it is, not how we'd like it to be. And by 2020, in the 2020 presidential elections, our hope is that sustainability is going to be a prime debating point, and we're doing those inroads into the political community as well. This is an interesting point, and if you think this timeline is really optimistic, well, yeah, it is, but it's also the same timeline in 1953 when Eisenhower arrived in office. General Marshall, former chief of the armed forces, during the chief of staff of the armed forces for World War II, and then Secretary of State right at the beginning of the Cold War, told Ike, we need a grand strategy. So in 1953, President Eisenhower stood up Project Solarium, where they fleshed out three options for grand strategy. One of those was containment, and he already knew he wanted to go with containment because he saw we were on the road to war, and he could not face that. He knew our nation could not face it. So he did Project Solarium. So in 1953, he started there. So by 1960, when Nixon and Kennedy were up debating, guess what? They weren't debating whether it should be containment or not. They were just debating how to implement it. That's what we want to get to. We want to just make sustainability it. And let's start debating how to implement it as a national strategy. We can do this. It's happening. The movement, the momentum is on our side. And just so you know, I talked about, is this airy-fairy stuff? Yeah. It's airy-fairy stuff. Is it utopian? Yeah, it is. Because when I was in the Pentagon, and people came, you know, so you're doing grant strategy, right? So I just had people cycling down through my office. It's, okay, who's the threat? You got to be talking about China, right? You're talking about Iran. North Korea. Who is it? You know, who's the enemy? Well, guess what? You don't have to have an enemy to have a grand strategy. You just have to have interests. As a matter of fact, we don't want to define ourselves based on an enemy. We're better than that as a people and a nation. And if you want to know, and people say, well, you're a utopian. I said, fucking I am. Oops, I knew I said it. Say, yes, I am. Yes, I am. I'm utopian. And here's why. From where we are right now, we can lead ourselves to a good nation. This picture right here is called Garden City. It was developed in 1902 by a guy named Sir Ebenezer Howard. And this is really cool. It's a full systems approach. And the goal is, and I know you probably can't read it, but it says a group of slumless, smokeless cities where people can live and be healthy. Now, he's a Brit, and he kind of didn't like the way the Industrial Revolution was going and everything. He kind of plays a role. So he created this system. There's food, there's water, there's energy, there's manufacturing, there's everything. There's even an insane asylum. I mean, everybody's included. And he was called Utopian, too. But he came up with a design framework. That's what we're talking about. That's full-spectrum sustainability 1902 style. And let's just get to a place. So can we get to the nation to a good place? Because guess what? Utopia. Right? That word utopia, the etymological drill on that one. Topos is Greek. Topos, place. So the U part, it can be spelled two ways. You can say O-utopus or you can say E-utopus. Right? O-utopus means no place. E-utopus means good place. Which one do you want? Because we already know what the O-utopus looks like. We're on that path. It's time to engage and have this utopian idea of the good place. Because remember, for the Navajo friends, remind us that you can't get to a good place in a bad way. You know? You can't get to a good place in a bad way. We just got to be grown up about this and recognize we're doing it in a bad way. Because at the end of the day, it is about this document. This is a great experiment that we are in right now. But it doesn't mean it's going to last forever. Matter of fact, the Founding Fathers thought it was only going to last 100 years. Best case. You know, glad they overshot a bit, because I love being American. But these first words, it says, we the people of the United States. It doesn't say waiting on Washington, D.C. It says, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, to promote the general welfare, and, like I said before, and most importantly, to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Guess what? If we're not doing all those things every day as citizens, well, you got it freaking wrong. You're not putting skin in the game. And oh, by the way, every one of those words, I'm stealing from Hubert Humphrey now, each one of those words, and we the people of the United States, in order to form, to establish, to ensure, to provide, to promote, to secure, those are all action words. They don't say, somebody ought to get around to doing these other things for us. It says, we the people are going to do that. So what are we waiting for? You know, if it doesn't fit into your political framework, go get a new political framework. If it doesn't fit into your economic situation, well, then fix your economic situation. Well, quit making freaking excuses. And I'm not just talking to you. I'm talking to America right now. I'm talking to myself. I'm no poster child for sustainability, but I'm sure as hell trying to figure it out. If I could just get my wife to sell her SUV, I'd feel a lot better. You know? I'm working on it, all right? But these are the actions that we can take as citizens, and quit looking for a political party to frame out how you ought to think, because there is no political party that's going to do that. It's going to be us as citizens taking a pragmatic approach to the utopian idea of us getting to a good place. That's what grant strategy is about. So it's just not fluff. The economics are sound, but it's also a way to engage citizens. That's why we wrote the narrative. That's why we're doing the work we're doing right now. And that's the stuff that you can do right here in the Northeast. You know, you have the opportunity right now. So as you go forward in life, I would encourage you to engage in this space. All right? Engage in this space. And what's it look like? I don't know. But I can't wait for you to tell me what it does. So thanks. Sir.
We have some time for questions. I'll start. Okay. And the one thing I wanted to say is I mentioned our partners. I forgot to mention the Costas Institute. My apologies, Steve. Costas Institute's a very important partner in this. So, Mark, I really liked your talk. I liked a lot of what you're saying. And the one question I would ask you is, who are some of your main detractors and why? Who does this put a bee in their bonnet? And why does
First of all, believe it or not, the national security community, because it doesn't fit into that the paradigm. You know, it's like, well, you know, this is what even talking about strategy with outside the context of ends, ways, means. I mean, people go apoplectic on me. You know, it's like this inability to shed their paradigm of what strategy is. So that's one realm. I mean, in the political space, there's two. On the left side of the spectrum, you've got people that go, your days with the devil, private sector, you can't do that. You know, you can't trust them. You know, they'll screw everything up. They're just, they're going to rapaciously. And I was like, you know what? As a Marine, we always say, fight with what you got, make what you need. Well, this is what we got, and we're making what we need. But the private sector is going to be key. There's a lot of interest because of the business, just a business model and a business propositions perspective. They're getting it. So just engage those that have like-minded. Are the Koch brothers going to get involved in this? No, they're not. But there's plenty of them. On the right-hand side, though, obviously, the conservative side, I mean, I've often gotten, you're selling out. You know, what happened? You know, obviously, because I'm a Marine colonel, I have to be a Republican. You know? Well, I'll have to say, I'm not a Democrat either. I don't know what I am other than I don't see purchase on the other side. But it's just manic because I get manic about that one because of just the inability to even consider that this is not a threat. The fact that Kansas in May or April, they actually had a state bill go to the state house that says that outlaws sustainable development. Even if it made the floor. Thank God voted down. But they got it that far. It's like sustainable development. No, you're not. We don't want any of that. It's like, how to even respond to that, So, I mean, that's the kind of negative response. But you know what? At the end of the day, I remember something that General Zinni said a long time ago. I heard him speak, and he said, somebody asked a question, some captain was all amped up about the media. The media's, we land on a beach, and there's media right there, and they're always in the way. They're always making and he's like, you know what? Media is like terrain. It's just there. So, there's nothing you can do about it. Just deal with it. Well, it's the same thing with the political spectrum, and it does help me to remember. Eric Severide. He was like the Tom Friedman of his age, and again another fellow Minnesota, but he was a 1950s guy. He had this great line. He said, the labels conservative and liberal go way back, and he said a liberal is somebody that has their feet firmly planted in the air. And a conservative is someone that's too fat to run and too scared to fight. So, it's just like, it's pretty much like, both sides are full of shit, so what the hell. So just try to take a pragmatic approach. I don't know if that answered your question, but that felt good to say. Thanks.
I kind of got a related question. I also like what you say. The second part was the sort of practical tactics, which sound very sensible. The first part was you talk to an academic audience, it's common sense 101. It's no-brainer. It's obvious. The world's small, that used to be. Yeah. Any strategy that doesn't rely on working together is not going to work.
Yeah.
But I want to know, in the military, do you get any? I mean, obviously, there's no reception in the public or in Washington about that strategy. In the military, are people more sensible about this? Say you're right?
Yeah.
Or do they say you're full of it?
Well, there's some people say, there's still, in every culture, military, we have our unique culture. There's those that are saying, they're very tactically oriented, but those that are in the strategy business definitely get this stuff. And I'm not going to drop names because it's not, these are in conversations in confidence. But clearly, you don't survive in a Pentagon doing this kind of work if you don't getting buy-in. So we were there for 2 years doing this. And we're still continuing the conversation within the military circles because they write, nobody wants peace more than military people. Trust me. Since 9/11, and even before, the thing I mentioned this earlier, everyone says, we've been at war since 9/11. Bullshit. My whole career, had been fighting. There wasn't a time where I wasn't in a fight. And I was in uniform for 28 years. We've always been fighting. And we just cannot. That cannot be our approach to the world. There's a role for it. But it cannot be our approach. I would rather lead with our civilian chin than our military chin. So, I think the military definitely get it. They understand the trend lines. And by the way, in the military realm, the reason why we even say sustainability is because everyone knew that, you know what, these guys are not on an agenda. They were taught, they were tasked to do something. And in the military profession, we're problem solvers. And so it was just our professional opinion. This is the direction we have to go. So I don't know if we're pragmatic idealists or idealistic pragmatists, but it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, just need to get on with the business of solving the problem. So, sir?
So I was interested to see that the innovation financing, of course, is a linchpin in all this. And one group I see that you'll have a hard time with are the venture capitalists, particularly on the West Coast, that have this Masters of the Universe complex that we can invent our way out of any problem. And that a lot of these problems that sustainability folks talk about can be solved just purely by the power of the human mind and creativity. And so how do you reach or get some of the Lester Brown sort of reality thinking or Amory Levin's thinking to that community, which I think is going to be very important in this financing piece?
I think number one, and I agree with you, I think there's a certain every community's got their own little sectors in it. So there's plenty of VC folks that are recognize this stuff and are willing to pursue that. I mean, we're obviously talking to them. There's others who agree with you. Well, hey, we'll just high tech our way through this. So first of all, the opening conversation is about opportunity space because that gets their attention. But we're talking about the space. But I mean, as you get farther into it, one of the things I try to mention is stealing from Lewis Mumford is okay, you can have all the technology you want. That's techno, skill, logos, knowledge, that's what technology is, or skill and knowledge. So if you don't have a freaking philosophy, a love, philo, sophos, wisdom, a love of wisdom to inform that technology, you're just going to get more of what we got. That's what kind of the Lewis Mumford 101, myth of the machine kind of stuff. And do they always get it? No, but it opens up their mind. I guess could number one, weird because Marine talks in etymological terms. But the other thing is, it makes them start thinking: is that you can't have a sustainable, you can't have sustainable investments if you're actually having deleterious effect in your investment. It just doesn't make sense from a business logic. So is it effective? I don't know, but those are the conversations we've had. So, anything else, sir?
So another comment I had is, I really like the idea of this hybrid top-down and bottom-up approach. And the ecologist in me sees the wisdom in that, because in reality you need both. Very few systems work without both of them. But given humanity's track record, I worry about that at least initially being symmetrical. In other words, that I think there's going to be a lot more top-down forcing to pull things along. A good example is like what's going on in the upper Midwest with the fracking.
Yeah.
We're basically sacrificing our groundwater to extract a lot of that energy. And so, great, we're going to have plenty of natural gas, but guess what? We're not going to have any drinking water or water for our crops.
Right.
And what forces are driving that? It's individual greed or private corporate greed. And so, how do we, you and I, no matter how many people we get together, it's going to take a long time.
Yeah, and I wish there was like a real great, elegant solution. So specifically to your example about fracking. So also looking at the Utica play, right? And so taught to Rich Cochran, who's the Western Reserve Land Conservancy. And so talk to him, because he's very from an economic perspective, he's concerned not just for all the environmental issues. He's concerned about Dutch disease in that area. So it's just, if the economy is only wedded to hydrocarbons, and taking that approach is pretty interesting. And he's also, though, very smart, because he's saying, okay, drilling technology is getting to a place where we could probably get the initial stuff, so he's making this compromise. We can get the initial hydrocarbons, recognizing, though, that that's not the long-term play. And using the drilling techniques today minimizes land damage, because he's a land conservancy. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue of water is now, if you can accept that, now that could be an engineering problem. Do you have to use water? Is there another way of doing
it?
And so now that creates a new innovation space. So it's a way of approaching the conversation. Now, I don't know if that's going to be the answer, but it's a different approach that's just not so. The answer isn't no, because when it goes to no, well, then the side that you're trying to, I mean, I'm with you. I want to get off hydrocarbons, and I don't want to use water to get at hydrocarbons. But it's happening. So how do you get it to transition? So the cool thing about that is, the transition point is, if you could use something other than water to get to those hydrocarbons, but the transition point is you use those drilling techniques so you don't have the drilling, all that capital investment in drilling, to get to geothermal, because those same drilling techniques could be used for geothermal, which is a clean, renewable energy source. Mm-hmm. And that would be a launcher play with minimal damage to the land usage and minimal water. And that's just the kind of bar napkin kind of thing. So that's just the example that comes to mind. But it's such a sticky booger about everything. It's just you got to engage it. I don't know how it's going to look, but we at least got to get started and getting the ball rolling. Very unsatisfying answer, but
it's one of those scary things where the time scale of the return is out of sync with the long term design.
Well, it is, and I got to tell you, the thing that concerns me. I mean, I'm a glass bubbling over kind of guy. You know, I'm just, you know, because there's no other choice. I have to say this. I'm going on a segue now, so I'm sorry. But or I don't know what the hell, I'm ricocheting off the page. I always thought it was really funny about the whole hopey changey thing, you know, that was such a bad thing that we talked about hope. I mean, in the presidential election, I loved it. I mean, I was like, I always thought that hope's a, you know, a human imperative. You know, we got to have hope. I mean, look at your kid. You know, my son comes home from school and he goes, "Dad, I want to, Brian, he wants to be a marine biologist. Now he wants to be a filmmaker, kind of combined kind of thing." You know, and I imagine my son came home with that. You know, and I said, "What? Stop dreaming, kid. You know, holy shit, that'll never happen." You know, you don't do that to your kid. It's like we're hanging a sign on you. It's like we're on Dante's Inferno. So knock down the Statue of Liberty. You know, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. You know, yearning to breathe free, and we're gonna hang Dante's Inferno. You know, all who enter here, you know, all hope abandon, ye who enter in. You know, I mean, what the hell's going on in America? You know, so we gotta at least engage. All the solution sets gonna be there, no, but keep in the frickin' fight and keep leaning forward into it. You know, so. I don't know why I said that, but again, that felt good.
It was entertaining.
Yeah. So, sir.
When you're talking about like a grand strategy, if you're talking about alternative energy, obviously there's so many things that we can do and should do. If you could design a strategy, what would ideally be like your first step? Because sometimes like getting started is the hardest part.
For just energy specific?
Yeah.
I would start. I'm plagiarizing from Amory Lovitz. I would just start with energy conservation right off the bat. I mean, just our built environment. There's so much we can do in terms of reducing our energy requirement. So I mean, basic numbers are, you know, top now. Actually, China is the largest consumer. We're number two as a nation. And if our built environment, if our buildings, American buildings, were a country themselves, they'd be the third largest energy consuming nation. Right there is huge. I mean, that's just basic common sense stuff, you know, with caulking, doing the basics, you know, materials you use to build stuff. So that's where I would. That's a very pragmatic, practical thing that, from large scale down to, you know, individual homes, you could start doing right now today, and that would be the great start. That makes sense.
Yeah. Any other questions? Well, Puck, it's been great having you here.
Thank you for having me.
I never thought I'd hear Marie talk about Amory Lovins. Great job. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.